Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinged through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You will have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? What's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways. And that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point. And that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday afternoon, 27th of May, that of course it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers without storming in. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Texas Police Made Wrong Decision Waiting Outside Classroom, Says Official. In the United States, the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety admitted on Friday, 27th of May, that, of course, it was the wrong decision for armed police to wait for an extended period of time outside the classroom, where the gunman in last Tuesday's school shooting was killing children and teachers without storming in. Police says updated timeline suggests that roughly 78 minutes passed from the time that the gunman entered the school building to when police officers finally entered the classroom where he was located. Meanwhile, students trapped inside the classroom with the gunman reportedly called 911, including one who pleaded, "Please send in the police now," as officers waited in the hallway for more than 45 minutes. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, shed tears and said at a tense press conference in Uvalde, Texas, where 19 young children and two school teachers were gunned down by a local 18-year-old, that there's no excuse for the failure of trained personnel not to have intervened sooner. At least 17 others were wounded, and the victims were all inside one classroom. At a separate news conference, the governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, showed no sympathy for the controversy facing law enforcement in Uvalde, saying that local police officials had initially misled him about the speed and resolve of police officers' response to the mass killing at the Robb Elementary School last Tuesday. "I'm livid," Greg Abbott said. "My expectation is that the law enforcement leaders leading the investigation get to the bottom of every fact with absolute certainty. The families whose lives have been destroyed need answers that are accurate." The mayor of Uvalde, Don McLaughlin, also claimed to be confused about Friday's revelations about the police response. And without elaborating, he said his staff would make any change needed if deemed necessary after an investigation into the police's response to the mass shooting. Stephen McGraw, Department of Public Safety Director, Greg Abbott, Texas's governor, and Don McLaughlin, Uvalde's mayor, all spoke on Friday as questions and anger mounted in the community over gaps in information, contradictory answers given to repeated questions from parents and journalists about what had happened, and silence on other topics about why more deaths could not have been prevented. The gunman, who had recently turned 18, came heavily armed to Robb Elementary School in the small town of Uvalde on Tuesday and killed 21 people after shooting and wounding his grandmother earlier. He was ultimately shot dead at the school by a federal agent. The attacker entered through a door that was meant to be locked but had been propped open, and after arriving in response to frantic calls from teachers trapped inside the school with the gunman barricaded in a classroom, armed law enforcement officers waited outside the door for about an hour while the killing continued inside the classroom. A specialist SWAT team, for which the officers had apparently been waiting, eventually breached the classroom and shot the killer dead. After several days of stonewalling and contradictory responses by other officials, Stephen McGraw led the press conference on Friday and cited the person in charge of the special police department assigned to the school without naming the person who, on the day, had led the response and held the officers back. "It was the wrong decision," Stephen McGraw conceded. The on-scene commander at the time believed it had transitioned from an active shooter situation to a barricaded subject, he said, adding the commander thought that, at that point, there remained no children at risk. "Obviously, based upon the information we now have, there were children in the classroom at risk," he said. He choked up as he was asked about the apparent tragic error, when people had continued to call the 911 emergency service number throughout the hiatus and tell them there were children needing rescue, and frantic parents outside the school were pleading with other police officers there to move in and end the massacre. Asked about a 40-minute gap in which 911 operators were aware children were alive, but police officers still did not go in, he added, "The decision has made that this was a barricaded subject. There was time to retrieve the keys to the classroom and wait for a tactical team. That was the decision, and that was the thought process. With the benefit of hindsight, of course, it was not the right decision. It was the wrong decision. Period. There's no excuse for that," he said. Stephen McGraw recounted some of the 911 calls, including several from a female who, in a whisper, reported multiple dead in a classroom. The unnamed caller from inside the classroom said, "There were 8 to 9 students still alive inside the classroom at that stage." At 12:36 p.m. local time, a 911 call that lasted for 21 seconds was received from a child inside the classroom who was told to stay on the line and stay quiet. The child, Stephen McGraw recounted, said, "Please send in the police now." Earlier, demands for answers multiplied as it emerged that extra state spending on school security and police officers trained for mass shootings had not prevented the massacre. Victor Escalon, the South Texas regional director of the state's Department of Public Safety, said on Thursday armed officers arrived at the Robb Elementary School in about 4 minutes, yet it was approximately an hour later that a tactical team of U.S. Border Patrol arrived at the school, burst into the classroom and killed the gunman, while the other armed police officers waited outside. Victor Escalon had given incomplete answers to pointed questions from reporters at a press conference on Thursday about what had happened, including how the authorities had said that an armed officer tried to stop the shooter as he approached the school, then had said the opposite, that in fact there had not been anyone to intercept the shooter beforehand. Telling the media he would try to get more answers, he said at one point, "Could anyone have gone into the classroom sooner? You have to understand, this is a small town." On Friday, Stephen McGraw also addressed the subject of earlier statements about social media posts. "I want to correct something that was said earlier on the investigation, that the killer posted on Facebook publicly that he was going to kill his grandmother, and secondly, he was going to shoot up at a school. That didn't happen," Stephen McGraw said, adding that it was on a message to someone else. On 14th of March, the subject made an Instagram post saying, 10 more days," the director said, to which a respondent asked, "Are you going to shoot up a school? Stop asking dumb questions and you'll see," Salvador Ramos allegedly replied. Adriana Martinez, the mother of Salvador Ramos, said in an interview with CNN local affiliate, "Forgive me. Forgive my son."
The Gaza Strip has been suffering a crisis and difficult humanitarian circumstances. Israel started 2 wars on Gaza that resulted in destroying the infrastructure and ruining most fields. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
لا لأنه you start Palestinian.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the faculty of journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalist syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their environment and interests.
When I first studied media, I knew that I would have to go out many times, and there are some surprising things that may happen. Especially that here, in the Gaza Strip, there may suddenly happen bombing or breaking into the strip or something like that. I know that my work requires that I be ready any time.
No doubt the female journalist students in the Gaza Strip could get the respect and admiration of the society and its support in different ways. This includes families and other parts of society. For female journalists, their career is respected among society and is not similar to any other career.
This is a full-time job that requires time and effort. I use my time here to produce some dramas that embody the reality we live and some social series. These series may be comedies or patriotic.
Indicators of the situation in Gaza Strip are frightening. Unprecedented levels of poverty, unemployment, and dependence on aid have put so much pressure on Gazans.
I started my work about 8 years ago as a TV correspondent. As soon as I started, there has been a lot of difficulties, mainly the political situation. Working as a a journalist in general, or a correspondent in particular, has its own difficulties. I'm a mother of four, and of course, coming to work, you always face the difficulties of coming to work, the threats everybody else here is facing, plus having to leave my children home alone. Well, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, I have to work extra hours sometimes, and my kids have to give in on a lot of things. I mean, I don't cook all the time, that's one thing, but they have gotten used to the lifestyle. Plus, our work is difficult when it's, you know, the season is hot, when there are war. Other times I have, you know, some easier times, but so it's give and take.
صعب على فتاة أن تقتحم مجال خصوصا في بلد ساخن.
It's hard for a woman to work in this field, especially in a country that lives many proceedings and a conservative society. The beginning was hard, but at the end, I proved myself and succeeded. I have proven that what I'm doing is a patriotic duty. Practically, if I manage work and home together, I can be successful in both. However, managing both comes at the expense of losing my comfort and psychological relief and even sleep hours.
Photography is maybe one of the most difficult media arts. That's because a woman is carrying her camera and taking photos like what other male journalists do. She exerts efforts and tries to be the number one. Thus, the way society looks at this was harsh at the beginning. They didn't accept that. But we overcame that now, and they started facilitating the female journalist's mission and providing support. Some people knew my name and missed me, especially during the clashes of East Jabalia, as I was the only female shooting there. They're contacting me on Facebook and asking me where my visit is. They also offer help in case I can't go there. At the beginning of my career, the first challenge was my father, brothers, and my husband inquiring about what I'm doing. I was able to prove myself and make them change their attitude. The pressure was big, that I was a mother and studying and working the same time. I had to manage these things without losing any of the three sides.
I was living in hard circumstances lately because I was doing my master's. That made me leave home for long hours, sometimes 12 hours. For sure, that affected me psychologically and physically. It also influenced my family, including my daughter and husband and my social life.
Luckily enough, I haven't faced any difficulties as a woman. I mean, Palestinians are used to women being always part of the life, the struggle. They have always been there, whether as political participants or working in all different fields. So I haven't faced any difficulties. I mean, the Palestinian society accepts the woman as part of it, so they even support us.
Nowadays, there is great development of the society's attitude to a female journalist. It became the opposite, as they would help and excuse her when she's late for home. Of course, there are exceptions. However, essentially, a successful female journalist takes care of herself and takes the society's traditions into consideration. This way, she will be respected, as I experienced.
One of the tiring things is that I'm pregnant and about to deliver a baby. It's possible to have the delivery symptoms any moment, but I'm still working. Despite everything, I'm happy that I'm working in my field and serving my nation and society. It's a national duty I should do.
To be a journalist in Gaza, working under aggressions, pressure, bad situation, financial cases of a humanitarian crisis gives you courage and a big power and strong points, beliefs, methods to do and achieve more and more and more. And this is very important for my job right now, to prove that you are strong to be here in this position.
My first experience in war covering was disastrous and sad because it was hard to see casualties and martyrs of your nation. However, it was a big challenge for me that I could prove myself in the field. Other journalists were helpful as I was moving with them in their vehicles. We used to move together whenever there was bombing or shelling to the location. I challenged myself to hold back my tears in front of the martyrs' families and the fragments of children's bodies. Similar things happened during the funeral of al-Darju children. I fainted after trying to touch their dead bodies. As a mother, I was strongly affected, and then I got over it.
We experience exceptional circumstances in Gaza. Anytime Israeli forces may break into the strip or bomb it, we may have clashes with the army. So I need to be ready and present anytime, ready to leave home to work to cover the news. This requires effort and time of what I say for my family.
I have just graduated from university and I started working before that. I was working at more than one place. I was an announcer in addition to other things. Besides that, I was a student and had a life. Society is divided into categories according to people's attitude to a working woman in general, and a female journalist in particular. For example, some people are open-minded and respect female journalists because their job is tiring. They have enough of work pressure, are in front of the camera and under different kinds of pressure. Some other people have another viewpoint. A woman cannot appear on TV as an announcer in an Eastern conservative Arab society. She cannot get dressed in certain ways and cannot be on TV from the first place.
The Women's Affairs Center in the Gaza Strip is concerned with media. It has a unit for television production and documentary movies. Many young Palestinian women start their careers from this place. The center organizes media courses regularly to improve the skills of the trainees so that they become able to work in this field.
The Women's Affairs Center has started training since 1995. We started our own activities by a Canadian producer who trained a group of 15 girls. It was a year and a half of training and documentary production. However, we first renovated the center, implemented for the strategic planning. Then we started a 200-hour training course for some young women who wanted to learn production, shooting, and editing. Our first experience included 12 young women. Then the next year, the number increased to be 20. A year after, the applications were about 100. And we started holding entrance exams and other exams for the candidates. We would also select the best trainees and the ones we feel they would carry on in this field.
I chose to join the Women's Affairs Center by a recommendation of a friend. I was recommended to join it to grow the talent I already have, which is production and television. I went there and registered for training courses for a year and a half. Then, at the end of this year, a movie was produced, or it was a documentary that was done as a production experience.
Here is a group of young women who are being trained in many kinds of television skills, like voice, filming, lighting, and production.
We asked the center to hold these courses because we needed a staff for dramas in the movie. We wanted to know how to create drama in the movie, so it was not a regular shooting. It had to be professional.
I'm the camera woman of drama and documentary films. I was the camera woman of Notice and The Ways, two drama films. I'm also one of the editors of the film Where Are My Stuff?
From the first places, I grew up in a sports house and was brought up doing sports. My family was and is still supporting me. They are the ones who encouraged me in this field. This has made me more courageous and honest. My father, may Allah grant him health, is the one who advises me and discusses everything with me. My father and I are close friends, and I consult him about everything. He tells me what to do without being persistent.
Actually, my family is very proud of me. I worked on the movie Hope Remains a Title and won first place, and that was the first movie I won first place for in the Cinema and Art Production Festival. Since then, everyone started supporting me and telling me what to do. They gave me the choice to go anywhere.
There's a story for my journey. Leaving home to office means traveling from east the strip to the west. This path was a minefield for me. As soon as I reached my office, I went on air and reported news happening on my way there. There were cars bombed on my way and citizens killed. One time, Israel hit a market on the same road, Omar al-Mukhtar Street. So the way itself was a story for me. Leaving home and reaching office was martyrdom. Reaching office meant I had a new life. During the war, we didn't know the source of the shelling. There was shelling by tanks, planes, and boats. That was a really wild war, as the only people moving in streets were either fighters or journalists. Press men were bombed either by targeting their vehicles or their offices. We were targeted in Al Alam Channel or Media Group Company with a rocket during work. They didn't consider the existence of journalists in the place, though there were press signs like TV press. The targets were journalists who represent media, and they wanted to silence us. Personally speaking, that war was a media war. Massacres and the killing of the innocent was broadcasted live. I think that holding trials for Israeli leaders or issuing arresting warrants for them by some European courts was motivated by media records. There were warrants of arrest or deprivation of entering some countries. These courts depended on the testimony of journalists. Thus, Israel realized how dangerous a Palestinian journalist could be and what are they capable of to highlight the Palestinian cause and suffering. And also to show that war aims at killing the innocent and not ending the resistance, or terrorism, as they call it. The main goal was killing Palestinians. The bombing was random and shallow. They executed massacres, used white phosphorus, and burned people. No everyone was targeted in the strip, either directly or indirectly.
The Palestinian media is a part of the national Palestinian resistance. So everyone is engaged in those clashes. In every Palestinian confrontation during the past 50 years, journalists were in the front with people sacrificing their lives. They were a target of Israeli assassinations. Therefore, this is a historical evidence for the Palestinian media. Even during the last Israeli aggression on the Strip, a number of journalists were targeted and murdered.
I would say something my family may not like. I was destined to have a new life twice after the first and second wars on Gaza. If there's a third one, I will be a martyr. I keep wondering why I'm still alive up till now. I was facing death more than one time. It is the first time to come here after the war. Those memories are ugly, but at the same time, make us feel how strong we are. This place was bombed, and seconds later, we came here again.
Some of us refuse to get down. This makes me proud of the journalists of Gaza and Palestine, proud of the cameramen and work crews. We are really strong that a rocket was shelled here directly. We were standing here in this direction. We were shooting here with our cameras when the rocket fell here directly on this building. Of course, the destruction remains are still here of what happened in the war. Practically speaking, the moment I would leave home those days, leaving meant we were going towards death. However, when this place was hit by a drone rocket, we started waiting for the F-16 to come. Actually, we turned it into a joke between us and a good spirit. Guys, where would the rockets come from? This direction or that one? This plane or that one? After all, we wanted to work and convey our message. We were scared, but we controlled it and got over it. I would feel I'm on duty and asked to go out and tell the world about what happens and shoot everything to transform the suffering of my nation. If I didn't do this, a mother would lose her children and the child would lose her family with no one knowing about them. Another woman would suffer regardless of being a mother or a sister or a daughter. At the end, it's a duty. It's a testimony for every female journalist in Palestine and Gaza in particular. They are strong. We have unbelievable determination that words cannot express, but we lived that a second time during the Second War. I also confirm that we're going to live the same if there happens any aggression on Gaza. None of the female journalists would back away. We became stronger with more experience.
Isdra has worked in this field since she graduated from university. She was always in the thick of the action. She is known for showing humanitarian news features to the world. Isdra has won the award for the best TV correspondent in the Islamic world.
It was something great. I didn't know about that contest. Those people were following up with our work and reports and collected works of hundreds of female reporters and journalists all over the world. At the end, they decided that I deserve the title of the best female reporter in war covering in the Muslim world. I felt it was the first reward after the war. Rewards are not necessarily money or tangible. The idea of having such a title meant that people were following up with what I was doing and appreciating that I was going to death itself for the sake of telling the world that there is a nation being killed and cleansed. There's a nation witnessing the melting of its people by white phosphorus in front of them. I succeeded in delivering this message, and this was what made me happy the most after the war until now. I could deliver the message.
Lots of stories in Gaza, lots of telling stories in Gaza, and lots of people, lots of successful, lots of negative and positive. And sadness and happiness and tears and furs and lots of things that against life and come with life. It's our turn, it's our responsibility as journalists to work in all those and put it in one circle. And then they cannot say that, oh, because you're a woman, you're sexist in this. No, because I am a refugee Palestinian. I know how to speak in my issue and how to present my own issue. This is my issue. This is my homeland.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. We now present you an article written jointly by Rowena Mason and Aubrey Allegretti. The piece is titled Boris Johnson Accused of Changing Ministerial Code to Save His Skin. Britain's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been accused of changing the ministerial code to help save his skin, ahead of a new Partygate inquiry that could publish more photographs and subject him to a public grilling by MPs. The Prime Minister faced a barrage of criticism after he amended the rules on Friday, 27th of May, to make clear that ministers will not always be expected to resign for breaching the code of conduct. Under new sanctions, they could apologise or temporarily lose their pay instead. Boris Johnson also blocked his independent ethics chief, Christopher Guyot, from gaining the power to launch his own investigations and rewrote the foreword to the Ministerial Code of Conduct, removing all references to honesty, integrity, transparency, and accountability. It comes as the Prime Minister faces an inquiry by the Privileges Committee into whether he misled Parliament over lockdown parties at No. 10 Downing Street, which could itself be a breach of the ministerial code. Labour and the Liberal Democrats accused Boris Johnson of rigging the system to get himself off the hook ahead of the inquiry. No. 10 Downing Street said a new version of the ministerial code, published on Friday, 27th of May, alongside a government statement saying it is disproportionate to expect that any breach, however minor, should lead automatically to resignation or dismissal, has the backing of the Committee on Standards in Public Life and Lord Gate, the advisor on ministerial interests. British ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament are usually expected to resign, which is stated elsewhere in the Code of Conduct. However, Downing Street declined to say if Boris Johnson would resign if found to have done so. One reason given for changing the rules was to avoid incentives for trivial or vexatious complaints, which may be made for partisan reasons. Chris Bryant, the Labour MP and chair of the Parliament's Standards Committee, said the weakening of the system was appalling. Chris Bryant said, "The new ministerial code is a disgrace. It means that the tiny semblance of accountability disappears. If you break the rules, just rewrite the rulebook," is the motto of this despicable government. Johnson remains under severe pressure over Partygate after the publication of the Sue Gray report. On Friday, 27th of May, he suffered the first loss of a front bencher since the report. Ministerial aide Paul Holmes, who said his work as an MP had been tarnished by the toxic culture that seemed to have permeated No. 10 Downing Street. Bob Neil, a former minister and chair of the Justice Committee, also revealed he submitted a letter of no confidence in Boris Johnson recently. He said these events have undermined trust in not just the office of the Prime Minister, but in the political process itself. To rebuild that trust and move on, a change in leadership is required. Bob Neil later told the BBC that the change to the ministerial code of practice was not a wise move. Rebel MPs are planning to use next week's recess to plot ways to oust the Prime Minister. One critic said the number of letters of no confidence had to be in the 40s, short of the 54 required to trigger a confidence vote, but more than the almost 30 MPs who have gone public with criticisms of Boris Johnson. A senior Conservative MP said, "Boris Johnson's value to the party as Prime Minister is now exhausted and events will take their natural course. I cannot tell you whether it will crystallise on 6th of June, after recess, or 27th of June, the return to Parliament after two by-elections. But the parliamentary party knows it cannot fight and win the next election under Boris." There is a widening gulf between the expectations of Johnson's allies and his critics, who expect to see him gone before the summer. One cabinet minister said he did not believe that Sue Gray's report had changed people's mind. He said either people are already bored of it or they are permanently enraged by it. I'm not sure anything is going to change now. But despite this confidence, Boris Johnson is facing a new headache with the start of the Privileges Committee inquiry within weeks, which is likely to keep Partygate in the headlines. Separately, it is understood the Greater London Authority's Oversight Committee is soon due to publish a report looking into London and Partners, the promotional agency linked to Boris Johnson's time as London Mayor, and the revelations about his relationship with a US businesswoman, Jennifer Arcuri. Three ministerial aides, Laura Farris, Alberto Costa and Andy Carter, are imminently expected to resign from their government jobs in order to be more independent as members of the Privileges Committee that will sit in judgment over the Prime Minister's honesty. It is expected to launch within weeks before the summer break and to last 4 or more months. The committee can sit in private or call witnesses in public, potentially including Boris Johnson himself, and demand further documentary evidence, such as photographs from the government if required. Sue Gray published only 9 photographs in her report, but hundreds were seen by her inquiry. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with a probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed. Boris Johnson could be found in contempt of Parliament if he deliberately misled the House of Commons, but he could also be in breach of the Ministerial Code of Conduct if he knowingly lied to MPs. However, the Ministerial Code is governed by the Prime Minister himself, and Boris Johnson resisted pressure to give Lord Gyte the power to launch his own inquiries without consent. Under his revised terms of reference, there will be an enhanced process to let Lord Gyte initiate inquiries, but he will still require the Prime Minister's consent before going ahead. Harriet Harman, the senior Labour MP, is likely to chair the Privileges Committee, with a probe expected to ask what, if any, assurances the Prime Minister was given that the parties were legal when he claimed there were no gatherings and that all lockdown guidance was followed.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
According to the latest Global Terrorism Index, there is an increase in terrorist attacks across sub-Saharan Africa amid concern that the region is now becoming the center of operations by armed groups affiliated to Daesh or ISIS and Al-Qaeda terrorist groups. Now, Western countries such as France and the United States have troops in Africa to ostensibly combat terrorists. However, due to an upsurge in terrorism, many in the continent are now questioning the real reasons behind the presence of these foreign troops. Meanwhile, civilians, especially women and children, are bearing the brunt of terrorist attacks in Africa. A Nigerian woman who is a victim of Boko Haram terrorist group speaks here inside a refugee camp. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on an upsurge of terrorist attacks in Africa, especially in the volatile Sahel region. We are asking, what are the factors behind increasing terrorist attacks in the continent, and how are Western imperialist powers linked to this deteriorating situation? In the second part of our program, we shall discuss the situation in Mali as the country's government pursues an independent policy. We are asking, is France, the former colonial power, undermining the government of Mali? Now, these are some of the questions our experts will be answering today.
An upsurge of terrorism in Africa. The 2022 Global Terrorism Index reveals that terrorism remains a serious threat, with sub-Saharan Africa accounting for 48% of total global deaths from terrorism. Four of the 10 countries with the largest increases in deaths from terrorism were also in sub-Saharan Africa, namely Niger, Mali, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Burkina Faso.
Following military defeats in Syria and Iraq, the notorious Daesh terrorist group shifted its attention to Africa's Sahel region, which is now the epicenter of terrorism. Gaspit, Mozambique in southern Africa, also witnessed deadly terrorist attacks over the last few years. A Mozambican here gives an account of his daring escape during a terrorist attack in the country's restive Cabo Delgado province.
Mesmo assim, no dia do ataque, eu já aquilo aconteceu enquanto já estive no centro de trabalho, estive trabalhando numa certa empresa. Então, quando aquilo aconteceu, eu logo já me escapei de lá, entrando na mata, já procurando refúgio. Então, até o momento, já não sei onde que a minha família está.
Well, to discuss increased terrorism in Africa and possible factors behind it, we contacted Nefta Freeman, a coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time and for joining our program.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Freeman, are you surprised that there is an upsurge of terrorism in Africa and particularly in sub-Saharan Africa?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to recognize that the root causes of terrorism in Africa haven't been addressed. The root causes stem out of the legacy of how Europe underdeveloped Africa. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, if we believe that there are no really inferior people and the African people are not inferior, then we got to say that this comes from somewhere and it has to have its legacy in the underdevelopment that has been put on Africa by the Western countries, and that those conditions, the lack of self-determination and being dominated by the Western world still exists. So you, as a result of that, there's marginalization, there's economic despair in people. We know that there are high levels of unemployment.
Most of the terrorist groups operating in Africa, such as Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab, are linked to global terror networks, especially Daesh and Al-Qaeda, all which follow the extremist Wahhabi ideology. Several reports link Wahhabi donors in Persian Gulf monarchies to these terrorist groups. What are the other sources of funding for these terrorists that are well-armed and apparently powerful?
It's a good question. I know that the funding sources are as elusive as the terrorist people can be themselves. And so, but we know that there's a lot of the informal cash-based economies of a lot of the countries and the regions that make it possible for countries to have, like, for groups like Boko Haram or whoever to use couriers to move cash within the borders of a country, like say from Nigeria or across the borders. The borders in Africa are very porous, as we say. And so the neighboring countries, so it's easy to move cash around. There have been reports that even I think it was Boko Haram that was able to actually raise like $70 million between 2006 and 2011. These things still exist in various illicit sources of funding operating in what I would refer to as the underworld economy. A lot of people call it just the criminal, but you know, I mean. The only reason I hesitate to use criminals because who's doing the, you know, who's judging who is the criminals? A lot of the imperialists and what they do is not seen as criminal. I see it as criminal. So I just, you know, I'd rather not, you know, use that word for them, but underworld economies.
By the way, just to add on to what Mr. Freeman said, lest we forget, Donald Trump, during his campaigns before being elected the U.S. president, said that President Barack Obama was the founder of ISIS or Daesh, along with Hillary Clinton.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
Despite the presence of mostly Western forces in Africa to purportedly combat terrorist groups, there is an increase in terrorist attacks in Africa. For instance, there are some 6,000 American troops, Defense Department civilians, and contractors across Africa. Recently, President Joe Biden also approved a redeployment of 500 U.S. troops in Somalia. Now, what exactly are these foreign troops doing in Africa since they have been unable to dismantle terrorist groups?
Actually, the fact that the groups do exist gives them the excuse they need to continue their occupation. This is a boom for the defense industries, They get to sell weapons to the African governments. They get to use their own weapons and make sure the people are the special forces and AFRICOM and the French Front Legion, all those are well equipped and have the most sophisticated weapons. So the military industrial complex, I would say, is a big part of what's happening here. I mean, we could see the militarization of the world. Divorce the extremism, radical extremism, from the West's militarization of the world, particularly the United States. You know, that's all it seems to offer the world. Then there's also the fact that this militarism and the presence of the West within these countries secures what Africa has been used for all along as a source of raw materials for the use of the Western world. So the hegemony of the West and the free flow of the raw materials in Africa has been a strong reason, a big reason, and admittedly so by them, for their presence in Africa.
Factors such as poverty and marginalization are said to be some of the underlying reasons that attract African youths to terrorism and extremist ideologies. Why have African governments failed to tackle some of the challenges that push mostly young people to terrorism?
Africa itself and the states in Africa, the people of Africa, not controlling their own politics and their own economics, distribution, land, all that. It's under the control of the West and foreigners. And so this is neocolonialism. Neoliberalism is that model of economics that puts profit over anything else. It values things based on profit and levels policies like austerity and privatization.
Speaking early May during a visit to Borno, a northern Nigerian state that has been targeted many times by Boko Haram terrorists, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for global efforts to tackle terrorism.
To support humanitarian action in Borno must to recognize the enormous challenge that Borno faces with climate change, with still Boko Haram active, even if weakened, and to invest in the Borno of hope.
Now, quite clearly, terrorism is a global phenomenon. Now, what needs to be done for better international collaboration in tackling this evil?
International level, there needs to be, and there actually are moves to do it, a reemergence of the non-aligned movement. If we remember back in the 50s and into the 60s, during the Cold War between U.S. and USSR, that there was the non-aligned movement of countries that say we're not going to be dictated to by the Soviet Union or by the U.S. and that any relationships we have with either will be on our own terms, and that the central way, the central focus is to look forward. I remember Kwame Nkrumah said it's not to look left or look east or look west, is to look forward, is what he said. And so that the principled task is the people of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and that those as much as we can, the countries, whether they're socialist or not, really need to embark on a movement that tethers itself away from Western countries and Western imperialism. So that has to be the first program.